up this mic? Seems a little low. Nothing. The audio's not working.
For this poem, the phenomenon is
checking it turned off.
Okay.
It's called Olamia.
Okay.
The other.
Okay. I guess I'm ready. Okay, so let's go ahead and get started if we can. All right, so the exams got passed back last time. The good news is that the scores were much better on the second exam. I was really pleased to see that the average on the second exam was just above an 85. The standard deviation was 10. And so on this exam, pretty much it would be about a straight scale, 90 to 100 in A, 80 to 90 at B, et cetera. If you think that we made a mistake in grading your exam, what you need to do is you need to write down on your exam why you think your answer captured the essence of what we were looking for in the answer. Has the solution been posted?
No.
Can you get it posted today? Yeah, we'll get it posted today. So please take a look at the solution before you turn in your request for regrade. You have 1 week from today in order to get your request for regrade turned in, and then I'll be happy to take a look at it and see if we think we made a mistake in grading the exam. Any questions about the second exam? Nope? Okay, great. So Stephanie talked last time about the burden of heart disease, the cardiovascular system, and heart attacks. And there was a video that she wasn't able to play from the NIH, which I'm going to take just a few minutes and play this morning, because I think it's a really nice video. It gives you a sense of what do patients experience when they're having a heart attack. And then what I want to talk about today is how we treat atherosclerosis. So we're going to look at three different treatments. We're going to look at open heart surgery. We're going to look at a procedure called balloon angioplasty. And we're going to look at a procedure called placing a stent in a coronary artery. And then we might get to, at the very end of class, what is heart failure. I think probably we'll get there next lecture. So we'll be talking about what is heart failure, congestive heart failure in particular, and how do we treat congestive heart failure. And we'll look at a number of treatments. We'll look at a heart transplant. We'll look at the use of a device called a left ventricular assist device, which is a tiny pump that you place inside the left ventricle, and we'll look at totally implantable artificial hearts and some of the challenges associated with making those work. So I want to, I'm going to skip through this because Stephanie covered this last time, but then what I wanted to do is I want to begin with a video from the NIH. While this was playing, I forgot we have a couple of balloon angioplasty catheters, so I'm going to run down and get those catheters while you take a look at this video. Hopefully, we'll get to watch the video. Good job. Mm-hmm. I don't have internet. There's no wireless in this room.
Heart disease is the number one killer of both women and men in this country. This year, more than a million Americans will have a heart attack, and nearly 500,000 of them will die. But it doesn't have to be this way.
sat down and rested for a while, and it went away. I walked a few more blocks, and it started again, and it went away again. My wife got upset quite naturally.
When he said it the third time, I fierce that is. I was like, oh my Lord. I said, what is it? Do you have any pain? He said, no. I said, do you have any numbness? He said, no. And I said, Bob, let me take you to the hospital. And he said, no, I'll be all right.
I'm the type that I don't never ran to the doctor just because I had a little pain. Something had to be wrong, and I didn't think anything was wrong. I didn't think anything was seriously wrong with myself at that time.
Patients often tell me that they delayed in calling 911 because they weren't sure what was going wrong, or they were afraid it was a false alarm, or they felt embarrassed about causing a fuss, or they didn't want to upset their family. But this is your life we're talking about. If you feel that something's wrong, you owe it to yourself and your family to get it checked out.
4 days later, Bob was at work when his symptoms returned, no intent this time. A colleague called 911, and the ambulance rushed into the hospital.
I don't remember much of anything. I mean, at this point in time, they tell me that I went into complete cardiac arrest. And I was in that complete cardiac arrest for 20 minutes.
When the hospital called, they right on the first told me, your husband's in emergency, you're in a city in this hospital, and he's having a heart attack.
My heart stopped. And in theory, I guess I was dead. But, through the miracles of medical science, they managed to revive me and bring me back to life.
Let's talk about what's actually happening in our bodies when someone is having a heart attack. We all know that the heart is the muscle that's responsible for pumping blood to every part of our body. A heart attack occurs when the blood supply to the heart is cut off or reduced, oftentimes by a blood clot in one of the arteries that feeds the heart. What happens when we have a heart attack is that the heart muscle gets damaged from the lack of adequate blood supply. The longer it takes to treat a patient having a heart attack, the more severe the damage to the heart will be, and damage to the heart is permanent. The treatment for a heart attack has changed a lot over the years. 2 decades ago, there wasn't much we could do to stop a heart attack. Today, there are drugs called thrombolytics, or clot busters, that can quickly break up a clot in the heart's artery. There's also angioplasty, where a balloon is inserted into the artery and inflated to restore blood flow. These artery-opening treatments need to be administered ideally within 1 hour of the beginning of heart attack symptoms. The sooner these treatments are given, the more heart muscle can be saved, and the better your chances of surviving and resuming a normal life.
Bonnie Brown and Joan Hamilton are sisters who were not aware of any family history of heart trouble. At age 44, Bonnie didn't recognize the warning signs when she had a heart attack.
It was a light, mild pain that made me notice something was there. And as soon as I noticed it, it went away. Then I said, okay, then, you know, it's just indigestion. When he came in and I saw the color drain from her face, and she's going, I'm okay, I'm okay. I'm like, you're not okay. I'm going to call 911. Let them tell you you're okay.
I said, she's making too much of this. Why is she calling the ambulance and just having indigestion? I'll take this ambulance and it's going to go away.
Understanding the heart attack warning signs isn't only important for your own health. Very often, someone other than the person having the heart attack is the one who needs to take quick action. The patient may want to wait. But if you think your spouse or friend or coworker is experiencing heart attack symptoms, you can save a life by calling 911 and getting them to the hospital as quickly as possible.
Bonnie was relieved to have a heart attack and was hospitalized for 2 weeks. Only days after being discharged, she and Joan were walking to visit a relative. Now Joan mentioned a mild pain.
It was in my left shoulder. And it was just in the shoulder.
She mentioned, I still have this pain in my shoulder.
I should go to the hospital. And I said, you should and you will. And I kept driving her straight to the hospital. And when we got in the emergency room, the doctor said, I had a heart attack. No, the chances are bad, I'm like, slim and none. You just had one. What are the chances of us both having it? I thought that the heart attack was for old men. I remember when I was too young to have a heart attack.
The truth is that heart disease is the number one cause of death among women, and the risk of having a heart attack increases with age, especially after menopause. So it's essential that women become more aware of their heart health.
When we go to parties, we don't go with the dips and the fat. We take vegetables and fruit, milkweed. Instead of using ground beef, now we use ground turkey. Instead of fried chicken, I miss it, but I use eat baked okra now. So then we can start with my food, squash, which I've never had squash, but
we got
any squash. We're members of the Johns Hopkins Family Heart Program. When we go to our exercise class each week, we take our blood pressure and our weight.
It's fun because now, due to our experience, our sisters and brothers are now in the same class with us.
We go to exercise together as a family. We do a lot of things together, and we're getting healthier.
Having a heart attack is a big wake-up call for most people. There's usually no problem convincing a heart attack survivor to change his or her lifestyle, to quit smoking, control their high blood pressure and cholesterol, control their weight, and get regular physical activity. Of course, it's better to take these steps now. They can prevent a heart attack from happening.
The type of exercise that I do now is I have a stationary bike that I ride for approximately 15 minutes. I have a course here and the community, which is approximately 2.5 to 3 miles, which I try to walk 3-4 times a week, and I just enjoy life.
Like so many people who experience heart attack symptoms, you might not be sure that you're having a heart attack, but you'll know something isn't right. And when that happens, the best policy, and I can't stress this enough, is when in doubt, check it out. Being prepared for a heart attack is a smart thing to do. Come up with an action plan in advance. Learn the heart attack warning signs. Talk to your family and friends about the importance of acting fast and calling 911 right away. And finally, talk to your doctor about your heart attack risk and how to lower it. Be prepared, act in time. It can save your life or the life of someone you love.
My doctor told me that if I have another heart attack, I may not make it through because my heart was damaged. I have no choice but to change everything in my life. Although I thought I was healthy then, I've got a much broader concept of health now, and I try to protect my heart.
I don't think he's ready to take any more chances. He knows how lucky he is to be here, and he can't be any more thankful.
If I can help someone else who hasn't yet had a heart attack recognize that they're having a heart attack, then I might help save that person's life. I feel very fortunate. I'm a very lucky person. I'm lucky to be here and happy to be here.
I have a lot of great people working with me, family support, so
I thought I would be just fine.
Questions about heart attacks. What I want to do now is move on to treatment. But if you have any questions about the pathophysiology, okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at ways to treat atherosclerotic lesions, and we're going to look at a number of techniques. And the first technique that we're going to look at is something called CABBAGE. CABBAGE stands for coronary artery bypass grafting. And basically, it's open heart surgery to go in and make a little detour around a blockage in a coronary artery. And so you learned last time that atherosclerotic lesions in coronary arteries are what are going to lead to heart attacks. And as the plaque builds up gradually over time, patients can begin experiencing some of the symptoms, like angina, for example. But what will lead to a heart attack is when you get a clot that completely blocks off all of the blood flow in that artery. And so in coronary artery bypass grafting, what a physician is going to do is to take a graft vessel. It can be an artery or it can be a vein. They're going to suture it onto the aorta. And then the distal end of that graft will be sutured past the blockage in the coronary artery. So you've provided another pathway for oxygenated blood to supply the heart muscle, which is downstream of the blockage in the coronary artery. So here's just another example of how you can do, here's one graft made with the saphenous vein from the leg. You can also take the left internal mammary artery, and you can, there's enough collateral blood supply which will supply the tissue that this artery normally supplies, and so you can basically cut it and then bring it in and suture it downstream of a blockage. These are the sites that people use to harvest arteries and veins for coronary artery bypass grafting. They'll take the saphenous vein, they'll take the radial artery, or they'll take the internal mammary artery are the three most common sources of vessel. And so in coronary artery bypass grafting, patients are under general anesthesia. What's going to happen is you have to open up the chest cavity, and so they're going to saw through the sternum and then use a retractor to separate the sternum. The graft vessel will be harvested, and then the heart will be exposed. So the heart is encased in the pericardial sac, so they'll snip through the pericardial sac, and you have to provide a supply of oxygenated blood to the rest of the body during the surgical procedure. And so the heart-lung bypass machine is used to take over the circulatory function of the heart and the oxygenation function of the lungs. So the blood will be diverted through the heart-lung machine, then the heart will be stopped, and then the graft vessel will be sutured in place. And then the circulation will be returned to the heart, patient will be taken off the heart-lung machine, and the chest will be closed. I'm going to play a couple of videos. If watching videos of surgery, if you don't like to watch like the Discovery Channel surgery shows, you might just want to close your eyes when we play some of these videos. So the first video that I'm going to play, it's actually a bypass to bypass a clot in the vena cava. But the steps that they're doing to expose the heart are the same steps that are done in CABG. Okay, we're just going to watch like the beginning 3 minutes of this video.
Presented with obstruction of the superior vena cava and superior vena cava syndrome. He had Crohn's disease and had a central venous catheter system implanted for permanent venous access. Unfortunately, the superior vena cava stone broke. Operation to bypass the obstructed vena cava was planned using a mini sternotomy. A 10-centimeter incision is made in the midline over the upper one half of the sternum.
They're right here.
The incision is deepened to the sternum. The sternum is divided transversely in the third intercostal space and vertically down to that point.
This is the retractor.
A small retractor is used to separate the sternal edges.
This is the pericardial sac.
The pericardium is open. The thymic fat is excised. Two cameras are used to show the details of operation. The overhead camera presents an image with the patient's head above the top right side of the screen. The metal bar seen at the top side of the screen is a second camera, which will show the surgeon's view. The innominate vein is dissected.
That's what they're going to use for this graft.
It is separated completely from surrounding tissues and controlled with a vessel loop.
Okay, I'm going to stop here because I wanted just to show you what the process of exposing the heart is like. Okay, and here's a higher resolution photograph. Here you can see the retractors in place and the heart is here. It's just the color of the myocardial muscle. Yeah. So you were looking at the ventricles in that picture. Okay. So the heart-lung machine is basically going to take over the function of both the heart and the lungs. So it's going to consist of a chamber that's going to receive the blood from the body. It will then pump the blood through an oxygenator. And the oxygenator is basically going to remove carbon dioxide from the blood and add oxygen to the blood and then pump it back into our patient through a series of tubes. And so if we look at the connections that are made, so basically what we're going to do is we're just going to intervene and we're going to take deoxygenated blood out of the patient, pump it through the heart-lung machine, and then pump it back into the patient and bypass circulation through the heart and through the lungs. And so here you can see the connections coming out of the patient to the heart-lung machine and coming back into the patient from the heart-lung machine. Typically it's a few hours, maybe between 2 and 4 hours. Yeah. So here's a photograph of a heart-lung machine. And then one of the important things associated with the use of the heart-lung machine is the hemoglobin is contained within the red blood cells. If you're breaking those red blood cells because of too much trauma to the red blood cells as they go through the pump, then that hemolysis is devastating for the patient because then you've just got free hemoglobin in solution. And so they use what are called variable speed roller pumps. So the blood is going to be pumped through vinyl tubing, and this is going to rotate in order to provide the pumping action for the blood. And then the blood is going to be passed through a series of permeable membranes. So the blood is going to go through here, and there will be a permeable membrane so we can have gas exchange between the blood and the gas that will be present in the heart-lung machine. And so via diffusion, then, we can use diffusion gradients to pull the CO2 out and to reoxygenate the blood as it travels through the heart-lung machine. So if we look at the effectiveness of CABG surgery, this is a very common surgery. In 2001, there were more than 500,000 CABG procedures performed. Typically, the whole procedure takes 4 to 6 hours, and it's associated with a 5 to 7 day hospital stay. Patients are up and walking the day after surgery. The good thing about CABG is that the grafts tend to remain patent for quite a long time, typically for 10 to 15 years. And so even though you have a patient who may have some risk factors for developing atherosclerosis, if you go in and you place these graft vessels, typically they will remain open for a decade or longer. And there are risks. It is a major surgical procedure, obviously. Approximately 5% of patients who undergo this procedure will have a heart attack actually associated with the procedure. There's also a risk of stroke. Patients have to be put on anticoagulants because their blood is being diverted through the heart-lung machine. And the risk of stroke is much greater in elderly patients. Younger patients tend to do better. The mortality rate probably is below 1% now, particularly in major medical centers. Between 1 and 4% of patients will have an infection associated with the sternal wound, and that can actually be quite painful. The more common side effects, there's a syndrome called post-pericardiotomy syndrome, where patients have chest pain and fever following the surgical procedure. It's a relatively minor side effect, but it's also common. And then there's also a side effect that's known as pump head. It's associated with the use of the heart-lung bypass machine, and patients will report that they just can't think clearly, that they seem to have lost some of their mental acuity following the procedure. They tend to regain the mental acuity over time, but it can take a couple of years for patients to report that it's fully returned. There was a very interesting article in the New Yorker, I want to say a couple of years ago, I'll see if I can find it, that was written by a physician who underwent the CABG procedure and then suffered this side effect. And for him, it was really the most frustrating aspect because he felt like he had really lost a part of himself as a result of having this operation and experiencing this side effect. So because of these side effects, there are a number of people who are trying to develop innovations to, number one, replace the need for the heart-lung bypass machine, and also to prevent having to do the open heart part of the surgery. So the first innovation that I want to show you is an innovation that's called off-pump CABG. And an off-pump CABG, what's done is they're still going to saw open the sternum, they're still going to expose the heart through the pericardium, but they're not going to put the patient on the heart-lung bypass machine. That means they don't stop the heart. So they have to do this surgery. They have to be able to go in and graft the vessel on to a beating heart. And so I'm going to show you a video of off-pump CABG. The advantage, of course, is that then patients don't experience what's called pump head. Okay, this one has no audio. So again, we've got the retractor in place. Now they're exposing the pericardium. So you can see there's the beating heart. And so now you're trying to suture two vessels together. And those vessels are approximately 1.5 to 2 millimeters in diameter. And if there's a leak in the anastomosis where those vessels are sutured together, then what happens is the patient is closed up, but now you're bleeding into the pericardial sac, and you have to go back for an emergency bypass surgery to repair that leak. So it's obviously a very, very significant complication. And so one of the things that they'll do is they'll actually use little vacuum hoses, so they can use suction to stick it on and help stabilize part of the heart to allow them to have something that isn't moving so rapidly when they're trying to suture the graft into place. So there's no pump involved. The heart and the lungs are still pumping blood and doing the oxygenation of the blood. So in a normal CABG procedure, we're going to stop the heart, and the blood will be, all of the patient's circulation will be diverted through the heart-lung machine. There's no pump. The heart is beating throughout the entire operation. So the patient's heart throughout the whole operation is responsible for circulation, and the patient is breathing in order to oxygenate the blood. And so it's a more difficult surgical procedure, But for the patient, they're not getting the same anticoagulants that you need, and the risk of having the side effects associated with Pompette are not there. That was called a mini sternotomy in that first video, and they were able to do that because they were actually going to do a different procedure. They were going to do a bypass around the superior vena cava. And so it doesn't require a larger incision to do an off-pump procedure than it does to do a standard CABG procedure. So you saw when they cut the skin, there was a lot of bleeding associated with that. And they're going to go in and cauterize the sides so that the bleeding will stop there. But the pericardial sac, I think it's fairly avascular. It's basically just a thin sac of connective tissue. And so when you cut it, you're actually not cutting any blood vessels. And so, you know, the heart is beating, but all of the blood is contained within the circulatory system. So unless you cut a vessel, you're not going to see bleeding. Okay, so the next innovation, which I think is the really just the coolest one of all, is called closed chest CABG. And so remember we talked about the laparoscopic procedures when we wanted to look at the ovaries and we wanted to do a laparoscopic biopsy of the ovary? Essentially, what closed chest CABG is a laparoscopic open heart surgery. And so you know, you've got space between your ribs. And what they're going to do is they're going to insert their trocars through the spaces between the ribs, and they're going to use fiber optic instruments to basically visualize what's inside the chest cavity and do the surgery using a robotic arm through those trocars so that now you don't have to use the heart-lung machine, you're not on bypass, and they don't saw through the sternum, use the retractor. They're doing it all through these mini incisions. And I have a little video. There was an article, I think it was in maybe the Sunday Houston Chronicle now, I can't remember which day it was in, about the surgeons in the Texas Medical Center who are using the Da Vinci system. So let me show you the video of the Da Vinci system. They're going in the spaces between the ribs, the intercostal spaces. LAD is the left anterior descending coronary artery.
The endoscopic stabilizer enters through a separate port and confers cardiac motion.
So again, they're just using the suction device. So they cut the vessel so it shut, so it doesn't bleed.
And the anastomosis is sewn with a 7-centimeter double-arm aortic curve using multi-angle, multi-directional movements of the Da Vinci instrument.
What's really amazing is to watch him tie knots with this. Okay. So there's a very interesting article written about the use of this device, and the link is in the slides if you want to take a look at it. It really is just fascinating. Here's the article. So closed chest coronary artery bypass grafting on the beating heart. Mm-hmm. So basically, when they use the retractors, what they're able to do is pull up and out enough so that the ribs don't break and you're able to get access to the cavity. How new? So this article talks about, it's from 2000, and here they were testing it in dogs. It's now being used experimentally in patients. And, you know, I don't actually know what the status of FDA approval is, whether it's only being used experimentally in patients or whether it has approval for use in patients. I'll look that up and let you know. The article in the Chronicle, and it was just last week that it was in, I can't remember now whether they said they were using it experimentally or whether they were using it as part of routine care. This was at the Texas Heart Institute. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll check and see what the FDA status is. I mean, I would imagine that given that they were doing large animal trials in 2000, and that the early experimental results in patients were positive, that you know, it may be at the stage where it's either been approved or about to be approved. Mm-hmm. So I would say that sort of the things that you have to balance out would be if you're not able to get what's called a patent anastomosis, so that you've got good blood flow between your graft vessel and the host vessel that you're trying to sew together, like if you've got a leak or anything, then you basically have to do an emergency open chest procedure. Now, obviously, at facilities that have the Da Vinci robot system, they're going to have the facilities and the experience to do emergent open heart procedures. So I think that is the major risk. And the advantage would be, of course, that you're not on a pump and you don't have to have the open chest procedure, and so recovery times are shorter. Okay, so the next technique that I want to talk about is a much less invasive technique, and that's called balloon angioplasty. It's also sometimes called PTCA, which stands for percutaneous transluminal coronary angioplasty. And so people will use PTCA, balloon angioplasty, and angioplasty fairly interchangeably. The idea is the same, and so we have a balloon angioplasty catheter. Yeah, I think we have to move this off. So the idea is that what they're going to do is they're going to cut down in the radial artery. And they're basically going to use fluoroscopic guidance, x-ray movies, to advance this all the way into your heart and into the coronary artery. So there's a little, I'll pass this around, there's a little balloon at the tip of this catheter. And so we can inflate this balloon, and I'll pass it around so you can take a look. There we go, you see it pop? You can pop the balloon. And so the idea is that you're going to snake this catheter in to the coronary artery. Here is the blockage. And now you're just going to blow up the balloon. It's amazing to me that this procedure works at all. You don't remove the plaque, you just kind of smash the plaque out of the way. And the really amazing thing is that you've got all sorts of thrombogenic substance in here, so you would think that in smashing it out of the way, you would make it very, very likely that you would just form a blood clot at that site, which would lead to myocardial infarction. But in fact, this procedure works pretty well. Patients typically take anticoagulants after the procedure, and then what happens is you're going to open up the lumen, and in many cases you'll get repair of the endothelial lining of the vessel so that the body will heal and basically re-endothelialize that surface. So I'm going to pass this around. You can see this little orange piece is normally taken off, and there's kind of a floppy metal piece, and that helps them guide this through the circulatory system. And then here's the balloon, and I blew it up with the syringe, and then you can play with inflating and deflating the balloon. Yeah, I mean, I've watched a couple of angioplasties before. I would say the hardest part is threading the catheter in to the site. No. No, they blow it up and take it right out. Mm-hmm. You can also go through the saphenous vein in the leg. Yeah. So, yeah. So, patients are awake when this procedure happens. And one of the hardest things for patients is they're laying on a flat, very hard table because they have to be basically doing x-ray video fluoroscopy in order to watch the catheter go through the circulatory system and position the balloon in the right place. So patients are sedated, but they are awake during the procedure. When they inject they inject a radio opaque dye, and it appears to me to be very uncomfortable for the patients. Many of them experience a burning sensation when they inject this radio opaque dye. And it's also, they're lying on this very hard table for maybe an hour or two, and there's discomfort associated with that as well. Here's just another picture of the same thing. Now here, this is what they want to visualize when they're doing the procedure. So basically they're doing angiography at the time of the procedure. So here is pre the procedure, and this is the blockage in the coronary artery. Here the balloon is actually in place and inflated, and the balloon is deflated and removed, and now you can see what was previously a blockage. Now you've got blood flow. So I don't know what the issues are associated with doing the cut down to get the. I don't know the answer to that. Yeah, I mean I know in general that the risks of all surgeries are increased. Typically, when patients are over 100 kilograms, the risks of all surgeries are increased. So, this is an example of an atherosclerotic lesion. And so here's the lesion, and here's post-angioplasty procedure. This was done in a rabbit model. So this is a normal vessel in a rabbit. They're fed a lipid-rich diet to make an atherosclerotic lesion, and then they go in and do the balloon angioplasty and then harvest the vessel following the procedure. So you can see that you do get quite a significant increase in the luminal diameter where the blood is actually flowing. Now let's look at the effectiveness of balloon angioplasty. There are a couple of situations where you can't really use balloon angioplasty. If you've got a focal lesion, so there's like one spot where you've got a blockage, put your balloon there, blow your balloon up, you're done. There are some patients where all along the coronary artery they've got atherosclerotic disease. Those patients are good candidates for a bypass surgery because you can go in and you can sew a bypass graft around it, but you can't use a balloon that many times. You can't treat what's called diffuse disease with balloon angioplasty. The other type of disease that's hard to treat with balloon angioplasty is in some patients you get very like rock hard calcified atherosclerotic plaques. They'll show up in chest x-rays because there's so much calcium there. And those cannot be treated very effectively with balloon angioplasty, basically because you'll perforate the balloon with the pieces of calcium that are present in the lesion. The biggest problem with balloon angioplasty is what's called restenosis. So we saw that angiogram where prior to the procedure, there was that very obstructed lesion, and immediately after the procedure, you had good blood flow. Well, in between 25 to 40% of patients who are treated with balloon angioplasty, another atherosclerotic lesion will form, typically at the same site and typically within 6 months of the first procedure. And so this restenosis or reocclusion is really the biggest problem with balloon angioplasty. So one of the advances that was developed to try and improve on this limitation of balloon angioplasty was a procedure called a coronary stent. And so I'm going to pass this around in a minute. This is a catheter to place a stent. And basically, a stent is like a piece of chain link fence, but it's collapsible. And so this is a stent that has actually been deployed. The stent that's on this catheter has not been deployed. And so you'll see that the diameter through the center of the stent is very small. But what's done is this catheter is advanced to the site of the blockage, and there is a balloon underneath the stent. We're going to blow up the balloon. It's going to expand the stent, and the stent will actually be left in place after we deflate the balloon and pull the balloon out. And so the stent, you can see, is now deployed and left in place, and so it's sort of holding back the rest of this atherosclerotic lesion. Okay? And so again, here's just a cartoon showing the same thing. Here is the stent, and the balloon's being inflated, and the stent is left in place. Let me pass this around so you can take a look at it. So that little metal piece, oops, we just pulled the dead wire out. So this little metal piece right there is the stent. I'm going to push that guide wire back in. That little metal piece right there is the stent. Okay. So this is an actual photograph of a stent. So here's the vessel, and here's kind of the edges of the stent that are hooked in to the wall of the vessel. One of the biggest advances in the use of stent therapy. Do you have a question? No, basically the vessel is just going to, the diameter of the stent is chosen to match the diameter of the vessel. No. One of the biggest advances in minimally invasive therapy of atherosclerosis is what are called drug-eluting stents. So there are certain drugs that are known to inhibit the formation of atherosclerotic lesions. And so what you can do is you can actually take a stent and you can coat it with these drugs so that it will elute these drugs over time. And the use of drug-eluting stents has really helped to reduce the incidence of restenosis following stent placement. So I'm going to play this little clip from NPR talking about some of the clinical trial results with drug-eluting stents.
Every year, doctors install devices called stents in the coronary arteries of 500,000 Americans. They're like little soda straws made out of a metal mesh. It's supposed to keep arteries open and blood flowing. But in as many as a third of these patients, the arteries reclog. When that happens, patients need repeated operations, and some need bypass surgery. Now, there is a new kind of stent that may prevent these complications. Since you have Richard Knox's voice, doctors can't get another.
The new stent is coated with a chemical found and discovered nearly three decades ago in a soil sample taken from Easter Island. They hoped it might be a new antibiotic, but that didn't pan out, so they put it on the shelf for years. Then, in the 1990s, researchers found the chemical blocked the growth of cells that line arteries. That led to the idea that they could coat stents with this chemical. They thought that might prevent the reclogging that often happens with delays by the Food and Drug Administration to approve the first drug-coated stent in late April. Dr. Jeffrey Moses of Lenox Hill Hospital in New York City says it's a landmark in the treatment of heart disease.
It's probably the biggest development in a decade. It's a revolution. I mean, this is a big deal.
In only 5 months, the devices have changed the way most patients get treated.
The latest journey is 60% of all patients getting stents are getting at least one drug stent. By next year, I would expect that it'll be much higher than 90% range.
Moses headed a large study of the new stent, published in this week's New England Journal of Medicine. It shows that even patients at highest risk of failure with old-style stents do dramatically better with the new drug-coated type. 9 months later, their need for new artery-opening procedures was 77% lower than those with the old stent, and they had 85% fewer heart attacks.
This is in a much more diverse and what we call real-world group of patients than the other studies have been conducted, and the others are sort of an ideal, very low-risk patient.
Moses and his colleagues own stock in Johnson & Johnson, which makes them a stent. But even heart specialists without a financial interest are clamoring for the new device. Dr. Deepak Bhatt is a cardiologist at Cleveland Clinic.
So at this point in time, demand is on strict supply. It's not that there aren't any of these drug-coated stents. There certainly are. It's just that as we are placing them more frequently, if we're placing them in more arteries at a single time, that might mean towards the end of the day, we might not have as many as we like.
The situation is different in Europe, where the new stent has been on the market a year longer. Dr. Andrew Marks of Columbia University says European countries are more skeptical that new technologies like this will actually save money in the long run.
Colleagues there tell me that they have put in hardly any of them because of the cost, because they're not covered by the insurance programs there, and only patients who are willing to pay out of pocket get them.
Even here, the economics aren't simple. The new stent may cost hospitals big because they make a profit on patients who need open heart surgery and end their life with procedures to reopen arteries. Still, most analysts think the new technology will save the system money, even though the new stent costs about $2,500. That's 2.5 times more than the old model. The new one is expected to have competition soon, possibly driving the price down. But Dr. Campbell Rogers of Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston thinks the benefits of patients could work out.
This is huge. There are patients who come back time after time after time that either are resigned to the fact that they will need repeated angioplasty procedures, or eventually everyone reaches the frustration level where they end up having open heart surgery and bypass surgery. It is a recurring problem.
When a new technology can help tens of thousands of patients avoid that, nobody is really counting the cost. Richard Knox, NPR.
Okay. So if we just compare some of the advantages and disadvantages of these procedures, with bypass surgery, typical hospitalization stays are 4 to 7 days. With angioplasty and stent, it's on the order of 1 to 2 days. So you're in the hospital for a much shorter period of time. However, if we look at the restenosis rates, they're very low for coronary artery bypass grafting. They're on the order of 5 to 6% of patients will experience a restenosis, and this is typically 5 years or more following their operation. So this is a procedure that has a very high success rate, and the benefits last for a long time. With angioplasty and with stents, the restenosis rates are much higher, and typically this is occurring within the first 6 to 12 months following the procedure. So you heard them talk about in the NPR piece. Normally what will happen is patients will begin with angioplasty, which is a much less invasive procedure. And if then you have a restenosis, you'll have another angioplasty, and then finally you get to the point where people say maybe it's time to start thinking about bypass surgery for you because you keep experiencing restenosis. So the hope is that with the drug-eluting stents, you'll reduce the restenosis rate so that they'll be comparable to that of bypass surgery. If we look at the cost of these procedures, typical cost of a bypass surgery procedure is in excess of $30,000. The angioplasty and the stent procedures are much less expensive. The cost that they were referring to is the cost for the stent itself in the NPR piece. And so the original hope was that angioplasty and stent would actually be procedures that would result in cost savings. But in fact, they haven't resulted in cost savings, because what happens is people will typically have multiple angioplasty procedures, and then those who are failing their angioplasty procedures will go on to have bypass surgery. The other thing that happens is we see expansion of the use of the procedure, because angioplasty is much less invasive. More people are willing to consider having angioplasty than are willing to consider having open heart surgery. And so if we look at the cost of beginning with angioplasty, at the initial treatment, patients who are treated with angioplasty that were spending between a third and a half as much as patients who initially have an open heart surgery. By 1 year, because a certain fraction of patients need to be retreated, we're at half. By 3 years, 60 to 80%, and post 3 years, more than 80% of what would have been spent if patients just had an initial bypass surgery. Okay. So let's suppose that you're in the situation of having coronary artery disease and your physician tells you that you need to be treated, and that your options are bypass surgery, balloon angioplasty, and drug-eluting stent. What do you think you would choose? How many people would choose open heart surgery as the initial procedure? How many people would choose balloon angioplasty as the initial procedure? How about drug-eluting stent? And that's what we're seeing more and more, is that the expansion of the use of the drug-eluting stent has really been dramatic over the last couple of years. I'm going to skip this slide. The last idea that I want to leave you with regard to heart disease, you can see that it's a very common disease, the leading killer in the United States. Most of our efforts to focus on heart disease, focus on treatment of heart disease, and treating particularly end-stage heart disease is a fairly invasive and a fairly expensive proposition. So when we look at bypass surgery, for example, we're talking about spending tens of thousands of dollars. Patients are having a major surgical procedure, and they're in the hospital for on the order of a week. Have we really missed an opportunity to think about the problem of heart disease in a way that could be much more cost-effective and potentially more effective as well? Should we be focusing more of our attention on prevention by reducing serum cholesterol levels, by reducing high blood pressure, and by reducing smoking rates? And there's a very interesting article that was in the New York Times, and I'm just going to pop it up. If you want to take a look at it, it's quite an interesting article, and really suggests that we're missing a big opportunity for substantial improvement in health in our country and a substantial reduction in health spending by focusing so much of our attention on treating end-stage heart disease and not enough of our attention on preventing heart disease. I will guarantee that there will be a problem related to this article on the third exam as an incentive for you to come and read the article before the third exam, and the link is in your slides. The last thing that I wanted to do is I wanted to play a video from Dr. Smalling, but we're not going to have time to play this entire video, so I'm going to go ahead and delay this until next time. He is an interventional cardiologist, and he's going to talk about some of the procedures that he performs, which are some of the same ones that we've talked about in class. Next time, we're going to talk about heart failure. There's no homework due next time. Yeah. Just as a reminder, our third exam will be in class on April 11th. And you will be doing your presentations on your projects on April 25th. And our final exam, I forgot to double check. Do you remember? Is this? I'm going to have to double check on the final exam date. I forgot to do that. Okay, thank you.
I have a question.
Yes.
Since I'm a media transfer, this is my first semester here. What do you know about the staff schedule?
It's gone.
It's gone.
It's gone.
So that test is on that
thing. Yeah.
Every time
I say. So, I need to double check that is. I think that's the scheduled date. I'm like 90% sure, but I forgot to double check it before I came to class. I know that there are a couple of students who have conflict with that time, and so I am going to offer one alternative exam time. And so I'll send out an email to everybody that says, if you have a conflict with that time, let me know so that we can come up with the alternative time. Okay. So explanations are highlighted. What does that mean? These are the PowerPoint reasons.
So discussion number 7 was 13 points, and I moved a decimal, but I think the numbers are correct.
Okay, I'll take a look at it.
Okay. The scheduled exam for April 11th.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually going to be on an RTC field trip.
Okay.
That day, flying back from London.
Yeah. If you can just get me a note from your instructor, I'll be happy to reschedule for academic complex like that. That's
right.
Fine.
Yeah, I have class tomorrow, so I'll get a note from them, and then I can bring
okay.
it on Tuesday.
Okay. Sure, that'd be
okay.
fine.
Thank you so much. Okay.
Yeah. You can just lay them down there and I'll repackage them. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Email will be the best thing.
And I asked the and the only parallel that I could make with it was with the class itself was just the instance where we talk about how about sorcery, and I remember when we had a guest speaker, he was talking about when he was in like an African country,
yeah.
and we make explanations like that. Is that like a parallel enough?
That would be good too, and also I would talk about the incidence of cholera in the refugee camps, because that's really what got the world's attention.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, are you missing for an academic reason?
No.
Okay.
We have a family that's lost.
Okay. Yeah, if you will email me, I am going to have to reschedule for the one other person.
Okay.
And so it would be best if we could do that at the same time.
Okay. And I also mentioned that I emailed for Zoom and I have a
Great. Yeah. I'm so glad to hear that. Sure, that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah. Is it good?
Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah.
I'm curious about which group I was in. I could have chosen.
Okay.
So,
which group you were assigned to? We didn't assign people to groups. Okay. Yeah. So, do we have some options?
Right now, you were doing A&C, right?
Yeah.
So I had emailed Darren because he had all of the viral.
Okay.
I thought there was one other A&C.
Yeah.
I actually didn't hear back from him, and I hadn't followed up on that. So that was by that. What we've done in the past is emailed the class, and then like today went back.
Yeah.
We may be kind of drying up on it.
Yeah.
I'll just go.
When is the next project assignment due? Do you remember? Okay. So we need to get it taken care of today so that you've had. Well, no, there's nothing due on Tuesday.
Oh, no.
No,
okay.
For sure there's nothing due on Tuesday.
Maybe another next Thursday.
Next Thursday, so maybe we have a week. Do you know Darren?
No.
So his office is upstairs in this building. It's really let's see if we can get it figured out.
And also I'm just curious about the answer for this problem.
Oh, it's my big list of everything that is freaking me out. Just send notes from home. Yeah, which is on the website.
I wondered where that was coming from. I was like, is she
getting
in the class?
No, it's a notes from home.
This is all homework.
This is homework and I think one book report.
Oh, that
is. Oh, sure.
Can you take a question?
Yeah, okay. It's really an early class, but I was just wondering, what kind of qualifications do you get from Facebook failures?
So with Facebook failure, you're trying to prevent arrhythmias, and so I think the real danger is that a patient will develop an arrhythmia, and then if the pacemaker has failed, you're not going to convert that arrhythmia back into a normal sinus rhythm. Well, I wouldn't think that would be a common complication, but again, you know, I'm not a clinician, so I can't think of anything that would cause that to happen as a result of the pacemaker.
I noticed that there was a class called, it's like an internship class, and I was wondering what that was. Like, all I just said is that you don't have to have experience.
Is this 410 and 415 that you're talking about?
So.
Yeah, so those are summer internships. They're listed as fall classes. We just do that so students don't have to pay extra tuition. So the classes are just